Saturday, February 13th, 2410. Saturday morning opened bright and clear, a beautiful opening to 2410's Winterfest. Day one ran like clockwork, a testament to Konami's meticulous planning and the hard work of her delegates, who had taken to calling themselves General Sterling's Colonels. The daylight hours were full to bursting with wintry fun. For the more sedate and artistic, there was ice skating on Lake Jaradar. For the slightly hardier, several old-time lake hockey games were waged nearby, with the rink defined by hay bales. Where had Professor May gotten hold of baled hay in February? And the players learning firsthand how good they had it, playing their regular games in state-of-the-art Walsh Arena. For the really hardy, and the speed demons, there were the ice boat races over on Crow Reservoir. Up on Castle Hill, the younger members of the Duelist Society cheerfully proctored the use of their clubhouse's perch, the only clear high ground on the campus proper, for sledding. Inside the castle itself, the senior duelists welcomed anyone who cared to stop by for some hot cocoa, perhaps a baked good, and a spot of good-natured interpersonal violence. They were having their alumni day that day, too, so a number of the club's alumni, Riley nicknamed the Elder Gods by some of the youngsters, were on hand as well. Konami spent the morning feeling like she was pretty much everywhere at once, and more than once she thought what she really needed was an international police lens. That way she wouldn't be at the mercy of student activities' slightly battered handy-talkies, which had an annoying habit of automatically seeking to the same frequency that was used by the drive-thru at the Port Jaradar KFC if you weren't careful. Several times that day she found herself trying to reach the Crow Dam team and finding herself taking somebody's order for a party bucket. Of course, that would only have helped her get in touch with a bare handful of people on Jurado, and most of them were over at the Xavier Institute, so she still wouldn't have been able to communicate with the two lake venues without the use of student activity's also slightly battered van. Things calmed down a little bit after lunch, since operations at the reservoir were wrapped up by then. Without casualties, amazingly enough, unless you counted Professor Hammond's pride, leaving only the skating, the freestyle snowball fighting on the practice field, and the action up on Castle Hill. With her most trustworthy colonels in full charge at the lake and on the field, and the radios more or less behaving, Konami felt, barely, clear to spend most of the afternoon at the castle. This was mostly in her role as Hamlin IV's resident advisor, since a number of her charges were attending the open house, but also partly as Winterfestführerin, as Professor Kesselring had dubbed her upon stumbling across her command post in the Hamlin IV common room. She had to deal with the band, after all, and they were all up there, or at least that was the excuse. Dinner in the Hamlin Commons was more boisterous than usual, everyone red-faced and genial, talking that little bit more loudly as people who have been outdoors all day tend to do. The fact that it was fully dark outside by supper time at this time of year was usually a bit of a downer. But tonight the darkness outside the windows, broken by the frosty glow of the campus street lamps and the lights in the windows of other buildings, seemed almost homey when viewed from the brightly lit, happily communal dining hall. "It's going really well," Lindsay remarked, her own voice raised to be heard over the cheerful din. "So far, so good," Konami replied. Everyone raced through dinner at an unseemly pace in anticipation of what came afterward. Konami had the sense that she was leading a parade, or perhaps an unusually chipper protest march, as the Res Group West students streamed out onto the common, past the frozen fortifications of Fort Sagara. The red one opposite had inevitably been called Fort Tesla, and met up with the smaller contingent from Res Group East in the center of the snowy expanse. Here loomed the fire pile, several tons of wood and other combustible material, intricately stacked and interlocked by students under the supervision of Professors Hammond and Mikulevsky of the Civil Engineering and Physics Departments, respectively. Maya Ibuki, the chemistry department's beloved science ninja, had provided a massive quantity of some highly classified accelerant, dousing the stack with a contraption that looked like the kind of thing an airport would use to foam the runway, and it had been soaking in all day. She guaranteed that, exposed to a temperature above a very specific threshold, the whole heap would be fully involved within moments. Hearing the target temperature, Sosuke perked up slightly and remarked, "A phased plasma rifle in the 40 kilowatt range would achieve that temperature easily." "No, Sosuke, you cannot use a plasma rifle to light the bonfire," Kaname told him. "Spirit, where would you even get one of those? Don't answer that." "Are we ready?" Kaname asked the knight in general. A roar like that of the crowd at a sporting event was her response. She turned to Sosuke. "Sergeant-at-arms, do your duty." Sosuke nodded. Having vetoed the plasma rifle plan, she was expecting him to haul out a fire lighter or a road flare at this point. But instead, he turned and marched away from the pile, the crowd of students parting to let him pass, until he stood about 40 yards away. Then he reached into his coat and pulled out a pistol-shaped object that glinted brass golden in the glow of the streetlights. This he proceeded, with a sort of ceremonious precision, to break open like an old-fashioned shotgun, so that he could slide a fat plastic shell into its breech and snap it shut. As he thumbed back the hammer and raised it, aiming into the air above everyone's head, Kaname could see that the device's muzzle was belled like a trumpet, and in that instant she recognized it. She'd seen something just like it in a movie once. Sosuke pulled the trigger, and with a sharp "phut," the antique Very pistol in his hand spat a brilliant red signal flare into the air. It traveled in a hissing parabolic arc, plunked down squarely on top of the pile, and easily ignited Professor Ibuki's secret accelerant. Fire cascaded down the sides of the stack, racing through the cracks and seams in the timbers, and within moments, just as promised, the whole thing was ablaze, flooding the center of the common with heat and merry orange light. The student body and assembled faculty broke into spontaneous applause and cheers.
"Ooh, classy," Lindsay murmured.
As Sosuke returned to her side, tucking his flare gun back into his coat, Kaname smiled and told him, "Okay, I admit it, that was cool." He nodded cordially. "Thank you, Miss Chittery." Sunday, February 14th, 2410. Sunday morning opened gray and overcast, a suitable air of tension permeating the air, heralding the conflicts to come. Although the morning was still allocated for sledding and ice skating, the majority of students who were involved in Winterfest activities were already directing their attentions toward preparations for that afternoon's entertainment. By the time lunch rolled around, those students who had chosen to participate in the grand experiment had gathered at the steps of the student union facing the commons. Those who hadn't chosen to participate, yet were still interested in the proceedings, had begun to gather in small groups along the edge of the commons. In front of Fort Tesla, Professor Charles Moore had dressed for the occasion in a battle dress uniform he appeared to have borrowed from the 20th Century Earth faction of the Institute's Society for Creative Anachronism chapter, the bright red beret on his head displaying his team affiliation plainly. With his hands folded behind his back, he paced up and down before his troops, surveying them with flinty eyes. Many of the freshmen from Kaname's floor were here, keyed up and ready to play. A few wore sports equipment, mainly hockey helmets and a few cricket shin guards. Rory Williams, though not a freshman, had joined his floor mates, toting a tall, curved, gaily painted red and gold shield he'd appropriated from the theater department props room, a leftover from the previous fall's Shakespeare on the Common production of Julius Caesar.
"Now I want you all to remember something," he said, his voice deliberately pitched in a lower, raspier register than his students were used to. "General Sterling told you on Friday that this was a game. But this is not a game. This is war. And nobody ever won a war with guts alone.
He rounded on them.
Wars are won with brains and tools, Mr. Weeks.
Here, Shark Week declared.
Is your invention ready?
Moore demanded. Affirmative, sir, Weeks replied, brandishing what looked like a cross between a vacuum cleaner and a fire hose.
All right. Everybody use your heads, think tactically, and don't let those blue...
He hesitated fractionally.
Bozos taunt you into losing your cool. We're gonna win this thing by fighting smarter, not harder.
Meanwhile, at Fort Sagara, Professor William McGregor had adopted an entirely different persona. As a proud son of New Caledonia, he was decked out in the full Highland regalia as if he'd just arrived from the Battle of Culloden. Most of the duelists who were taking part were on his side, as well as a handful of the alumni who'd come to campus for the festival. Down in front, Amy Pond, probably the only person in the Bahava L system who was more Scottish than McGregor, being from the genuine and original Inverness, had taken his theme fully on board, sporting not only slightly ragged Clan Macintosh tartan, but vivid blue war paint. Nobody else had gone quite that far, but they all looked cheerfully up for a scrap.
I'll bet you anything,
McGregor bellowed, his burr even broader than usual.
Old Nancy Moore is over there right now, telling his kids that this is a war, and you win a war with smarts. But we all knew that isn't so. You win a war by being harder than the other fella, by nae being afraid.
He brandished his round Scots targe.
By knowing that they may take our lives, but never our honor. Now go out there and show him what for.
After the faculty advisor pep talks, the first couple of rounds were almost anticlimactic. Fought with small squads, skirmish style, they were only intended to test the mechanics and make sure the timing of the game actually worked. The referee panel, two deans, Odo and President Tiefeld, carried out a few rules adjustments on the fly, tweaking the precise workings of the game based on the results of these rounds, and by 1:30 everything was in place for the all-hands showdowns to begin. Blue took the first round, but messily, with heavy losses. Red took the second, but it was a laborious process, featuring a number of gambits that were canny and well thought out, but lacked something in spectator appeal. For the third and final tie-breaking round, the referees ruled that the faculty captains were far too invested in the thing and ordered them off the field, to be replaced with player captains selected by popular demand. To no one's great surprise, the duelist-heavy Blues immediately dragooned their emeritus VP, the most senior member of the Intergalactic Duelists Federation participating in the game. To no one else's great surprise, the Hamlin 4th-dominated Reds responded by naming their beloved RA. Stepping to the center of the pitch for the kickoff to Round 3, Kaname grinned and inquired, "You ready for this, Utena?" Utena Tenjo responded with a trademark grin of her own and replied, "Let's give him a show." "Oh, it is on!" Lindsay Willows cried happily from the blue side as the 30-second warning horn sounded. The two captains shook hands ceremoniously, parted, and walked back to their lines. "What's the plan, Miss Chittery?" Sosuke inquired as Kaname entered the red command post. Kaname grinned. "That's your department, Sergeant-at-Arms." Sosuke looked a little taken aback for a moment, then smiled slightly and gestured for the others to gather around. When they had, he indicated points on the big tactical map and began rapping out instructions. "Kazama, Holstein, Kruger, proceed to point Delta 4 and await Miss Chittery's signal. Avoid engagement until that time, if at all possible. Yumemiya, Wong, Williams, I need you right here. Woods, Hallard, Sano, echelon left. Mukai, Inaba, Zak, echelon right. Everyone else, stay here, Defense Formation C, but be prepared to move out. Miss Chittery, you're with me." Outside, the commence game siren wailed. Kaname's grin widened. She clapped the sergeant on one shoulder, grabbed a snowball out of the nearest bin, and said, "Right then. Let's get it on." Red's assault force burst out of Fort Sagara with a suddenness and cohesion that took Blue somewhat by surprise. They were clearly expecting a few opening minutes of probing attacks and feints, not a frontal assault, but they were ready to defend themselves. The main force encountered heavy resistance almost from the start, first in the form of plunging fire from the Fort Tesla battlements, then, as they drew nearer, direct fire from the frontline defenders. Trainee Invader Zack was the first to get it, falling with a despairing cry of, "I have failed you, my not quite as tallest," as they crossed the center line of No Man's Land. On the left flank, Irina Woods was next to go, although, with a mighty effort, she dispatched her roommate even as she fell. When they reached the outer perimeter of the blue side itself, Sosuke put the next phase of his plan into action, relaying instructions through Kaname and her handy-talkie. On the far side, having crept into position all but unnoticed amid the fury of the frontal attack, Shinji Kazama's sapper team began scaling the rear of the fort, stealthily eliminating the handful of blues chafing at their rearguard assignments. Once they were in position, Kaname, at a tense nod from Sosuke, ordered the breaching phase to commence. Arika, Nina, and Rory broke away from the main force and ran for the Union side front corner of the opposing team's fort, Sosuke and Kaname a bit to their right, the rest of the formation trailing a few paces and maintaining volley fire over their heads. To the left, in the most exposed position on the wedge, Rory hustled along next to the two girls, keeping them covered with his giant shield. Arika glanced at her roommate, asked quickly with a grin, "The 1-2?" and received a curt nod in reply. Nina and Rory sprinted ahead to the base of the fort, using an inside corner of the walls for cover from two sides while Rory hunkered down and grounded his shield to cover the third. Arika took a moment longer to accept snowballs from her teammates, handed to her while on the run. Then, without breaking stride, her arms full of snowballs, she ran straight for Nina, who had crouched down and laced her hands together. As soon as Arika's foot was in Nina's improvised sling, Nina bent her entire body back and raised her arms, launching Arika into the air with a mighty "Hup!" Now airborne, Arika easily soared over the upper ramparts of the base, taking the few students stationed up top by surprise. Skillfully thrown snowballs pasted two in the face, and the remainder were dumped, claymore style, on three more before she landed among their fallen forms. With the top now distracted, Arika called out to her companions, "The top's clear! Go, go, go!" As Sosuke, Kaname, and the rest of the assault force scaled the glacis, Arika rushed to the nearest snow bin to resupply for the inevitable counterattack. When it came, it was massive and furious, all hands on the blue team rallying to defend the nerve center of their citadel. Had it been anything more serious than a snowball fight, the carnage would have beggared description, because, with the hour growing late, everyone sensed that this was it. Seeing that Blue hadn't had time to mount a strike of their own, Kaname called out most of the reserves she and Sosuke had left behind. The final confrontation, the climactic battle of this epic afternoon, was at hand. Amid the melee, 100 little dramas played out individually. In lonely corners of the battlefield, friends, roommates, even brothers and sisters were pitted against each other in this final, feral, merciless phase of the Snow Wars, often with endings that were straight out of Greek tragedy. As everyone had known from the start was inevitable, Amy and Rory exterminated each other all but simultaneously, Rory abandoning his shield upright to protect Kaname's left flank, and then fearlessly meeting his lover's bonsai charge with one of his own. Off to the right, Nina and Arika perished in a withering crossfire set up by Lindsay and Boba Fett, before the former fell to Shark Week's snow bazooka, and Tom Palmer, having traitorously agreed to switch sides for balance's sake after round two, picked off the latter with a surgically applied snow slider. Onager fire from the upper battlement swept away much of the red afterguard before Shinji's sappers, striking from behind, could silence the weapon and most of its crew. Spying the pink streamer of Uchina's hair as she jumped down from the doomed Onager's platform with black-clad Corwin Ravenhair alongside her, Sasuke turned to Kaname and said, "Miss Tenjo's all yours, Miss Chidori. I'll deal with Ravenhair." Kaname nodded and went to the left as Sosuke broke right, loading up his non-throwing arm as he went. And so, as everyone had also known would be inevitable, it came down to a sniper's duel between team captains. While their bodyguards were busy annihilating each other with massed fire, Utena Tenjo and Kaname Sterling pitted their pitching arms against each other across the circular gallery overlooking the flag room. A distance, entirely by design, of exactly 60.5 feet. In many ways, this was a classic confrontation. Lefty versus righty, power versus finesse. Utena's crushingly direct four-seam fastball against Kaname's trademark viciously late-breaking cutter. While the combatants dug themselves out of the deep spots, brushed themselves off, laughed uproariously, and in a couple of cases got in a little surreptitious making out under the cover of snowdrifts before emerging, the final score had to be determined with a frame count of video footage from Chie Hallard's handycam. This showed that, though both teams had suffered 100% losses in that final assault, and therefore, strictly speaking, no one had won round three, Red's captain had lived exactly 0.027 seconds longer than Blue's. Therefore, based on the overall scores, Red were the afternoon's ultimate winners, though all agreed that, in the final analysis, they'd all won because, damn, we are so doing this again next year. Hearing the verdict at the scorer's table, Utena finished wiping snow out of her eyes, turned to Kaname, and offered her hand again with a smile, remarking, "You've got a hell of a breaking ball there. Good game." "Thanks," said Kaname, shaking it. "Are you guys staying for the dance?" "Wouldn't miss it." 1900 hours. Having combed the snow out of their hair, changed clothes, and grabbed a quick dinner, the students reconvened in the grand ballroom. This was an altogether less, well, formal affair than the spring formal. There was no Chamberlain at the Winterfest dance, no announcement cue, no photo line, not even the standard tacit expectation that the attendees would come as couples, though most still did. In keeping with the Winterfest Sanity Week theme, it was more like a big school-sanctioned party. Come as you are, and be prepared to get down. The ballroom was configured in a modified concert auditorium setup. Up on the stage, the briefing equipment from Kaname's introductory speech on Friday had been removed, the curtain closed, and the risers, amps, and stacks of a rock band erected on the apron, along with the union's upright piano. But down in the main room, the floor was as devoid as ever of seating, apart from the benches along the room's long walls. Precisely on the dot of 7, the band took the stage, 6 figures unmistakable to anyone at all familiar with the school's history. A slim, dusky girl with wiry gray hair, her golden eyes glittering in the stage lights. A dark-eyed, auburn-haired young woman in a black tank top printed with an industrial safety sign. "Danger. This machine rocks automatically." The massive, black-clad form of a Hoffmanite. A slender, blue-haired young man in a ruffly shirt and leather jeans. A bespectacled brunette in what looked to be a white marching band jacket and cargo pants. And a tiger, wearing sunglasses. "Ladies and gentle beings," Moose McEachern boomed, not requiring amplification to reach the farthest corners of the ballroom with his stentorian voice. "Welcome to the 4th annual Winterfest dance. We are the Art of Noise." And with no more build-up than that, they were off, laying down the intro of the song they'd chosen as this year's regular opener. Kaname watched from the sidelines as her classmates danced and mingled, enjoying the music in the moment. Despite Kate's concerns that the Art of Noise was more accustomed to playing concerts, where the audience might occasionally get up and boogie in the aisles in reaction to one song or another, and not an actual full-on dance, the band acquitted itself admirably. The people around her were getting down and feeling the sound, as the saying went. Kaname half suspected that Kate had been protesting more as a matter of form than an actual legitimate complaint anyway. If her expression was anything to go by, Kate was experiencing no doubt about the gig now, as she stepped to the center mic and hit the chorus harmony with Azalin and Miki on either side of her. Besides, didn't they play the music for Anthy and Utrina's wedding reception? From all reports, that was spectacular, Kaname reflected to herself with a grin. Hutchins, thou doth protest too much. One of the things the students in the know were waiting for during the first set at the Winterfest dance/concert was the guest stars. For some time now, the Art of Noise had been known within their fanbase for abruptly producing the most unexpected guests during their shows, usually without any advance promotion whatever. The superconducting Super Colliders, Minmay and the Marauders, Cheryl Gnome, you just never knew who might suddenly take the stage alongside Kate and the gang during an Art of Noise performance. The first set ended without one, though, as most of the band left the stage while Caitlin stayed behind her bank of keyboards. All the lights went down apart from the one on her, as, without comment, she busied herself making some config changes to the stack of gear that stood to her right. This was also part of the Art's standard operating procedure. After a few moments of this, she squared herself behind the array, touched a key, and a spine-chilling electric sound planed down to a simple but driving bass line that hammered from the speakers. The signature undercurrent of the most distinctive television music in the galaxy, the theme from Professor Enigma. She played a very minimalist version of it at first, twice through the main theme with the soaring bridge section in between, held the last note of the outro for a moment, and then started again, this time with a much bigger sound. This arrangement was new, not precisely any of the many versions that had graced the show's opening titles since its debut in the mid-20th century, with the kind of lush instrumentation that suggested it was meant to be played with a full orchestra's backing. Sharp-eared fans, and there were more than a few in this audience, caught some of the distinctive sounds of the very first arrangement, circa 1963, layered into the soundscape. Others remarked to themselves, it being largely impossible at this point to remark to anyone else, that her synthesizer array was doing a really good job of simulating the sound of an orchestra behind her. Until the lights came back up in the middle of the reiterated bridge, and they saw that she had an orchestra behind her, along with the rest of the Art of Noise. The Art were known for creeping back during the blackout, but to bring an entire concert orchestra with them was taking the stunt to something of a new level. They finished the theme with a variant on the traditional thundering crescendo. As it was fading, before anyone in the audience recovered enough to start applauding, a woman nobody recognized emerged into the light a short distance from Caitlin. About Kate's age and serious-looking, with dark hair pulled back in a rather severe French braid, she was dressed in a kind of Victorian adventuress costume, if adventuress in Victorian times had applied two-fisted tomboy action and not unsuitable romantic decisions. White high-collared shirt, blue waistcoat with watch chain, sharply creased turn-up trousers and sturdy shoes. She stepped up to the center mic, vacant since Kate was behind the keyboards, and said, in a quiet but intense, portentous voice, "No one would have believed, in the last years of the 19th century, that human affairs were being watched by intelligences which inhabited the timeless worlds of space. No one could have dreamed we were being scrutinized, as someone with a microscope studies creatures that swarm and multiply in a drop of water. Few men even considered the possibility of life on other planets. And yet, across the gulf of space. Minds immeasurably superior to ours regarded the Earth with envious eyes, and slowly and surely they drew their plans against us. Even in a student body as eclectic as DSM's, there were relatively few young people who had heard of the 1970s rock opera version of The War of the Worlds, but after the Art of Noise's performance of its first song, quite a number made mental notes to track it down, even if it had been a bit difficult to dance to, and to find out who the woman was who was doing the narration and the vocals.
The chances of anything coming from Mars are a million to one, he said. Chances of anything coming from Mars are a million to one, but still they come.
The first time that refrain appeared, the school's one Martian student got a big laugh from those near her by shrugging with a, "Well, hey, what are you going to do?" expression on her face. At the song's end, the woman in the Victorian waistcoat broke her character's serious mien with a dazzling great smile and declared, "Ladies and gentlemen, all the way from Westminster Prime, give it up for the BBC Ethereophonic Orchestra!" While they cheered, she raked her fingers through her hair, shaking it out of the braid and down around her shoulders, and suddenly at least a handful of people in the audience realized who she was. She wasn't galactically famous, certainly not to the standard established by other Art of Noise guest stars over the years, but she'd enjoyed a certain amount of success in the Crown colonies, which were well represented in DSM's student population. True, when they'd last seen her, she was appearing in the music video for the one song of hers that had charted off her homeworld, and in that she was blonde and dressed like a skater girl, not a brunette in Victorian gentleman drag. But no one who had ever seen Rose Tyler smile like that could ever really be said to forget it. When the lights went out on the orchestra, Rose and the Art played that one song, a bit poppy by Art of Noise standards in its original incarnation, but they rocked it up nicely, reinforcing some people's suspicions that it had been intended to be harder-edged when originally written. Then she joined them for the Art's signature "Welcome, Guest Artists" number, "I Think I Like It," after which she thanked them and Kate and left the stage. Only once she was gone did it occur to many students that she hadn't actually mentioned who she was, leaving it for the people who knew to explain to the people who didn't. Naturally, when the lights came up again behind the band, the orchestra was gone, and the Art went on with their second set as if nothing unusual had happened. They looked like they could have gone all night, but even the Winterfest dance eventually had a curfew, and as the time came up toward 10 p.m., they started to wind things up. Kate reiterated the names of her bandmates as, one by one, they dropped out of the long wind-out of Sultans of Swing, a practice she referred to as outroduction, and left the stage, until finally she was once more alone. She finished Sultans alone, racked her Stratocaster, and went back to the keyboards. For a second, it looked like she was just going to start shutting things off, thank everyone for coming, and go. But then a thoughtful look crossed her face, and she switched her keyboard-stacked mic back on. "So listen," she said. "I've been gone for a while. Does the school still have that rule about public displays of affection?" "Yes," the crowd replied, a trifle ruefully. Kate considered that for a second, then said, "Well, sorry in advance, then," and began to play a slow, deliberate, faintly haunting melody in a synthetic organ voice. "Now that's just mean," thought Kaname Riley. She leaned against the upright of the archway leading out to the student union's main lobby, her eyes seeking out various couples and little groups as they danced or just hung out, to Kate's cover of Procol Harum's A Whiter Shade of Pale. Slow numbers at dances and school policies on PDA had always and forever been in opposition, and Kaname was pleased to see that both sides of the eternal divide were doing what they could to maintain détente tonight, the students by not pushing the line too far, their chaperones by not towing it too strictly. Indeed, the only really diligent chaperoning going on right now, she noticed with a suppressed giggle, appeared to be Professor Steinberg struggling to keep Professor Sugiura off Professor Hammond, and that had been going on more or less all night. There'd been a lot of mixing and matching over the course of the evening, naturally, but for this last number it seemed like all the school's canonical couples were out on the floor. Natsuki and Shizuru, playing it cool, as though they could have just happened to be dancing with anyone, like that was fooling anybody. Chie and Aoi, strange to see them moving so slowly under any circumstances. Amy and Rory might have been the only people out there, so collected and smooth she could almost believe they'd done this 1,000 times. Shark Week and Nalina, hey, why not? Steve Ducat and Nita Duran, ditto. Kazuya and Akane, no surprises there. Mizuki and... hang on, Mizuki and Boba Fett, really? Well, okay, he's a lot better than the last jerkweed she dated.
At first just go sleep. Turn the wider shade of pale.
Kaname smiled to herself. Yeah, see, this was why she got involved in things like this. Not for power or for glory, but for the satisfaction of seeing her friends having a good time and knowing that she had a hand in making it come to pass. She suddenly detected a presence at her side. Turning, she saw Sosuke Sagara, a flute of mineral water in each hand. He presented one to her, keeping the other for himself. "Thanks," she said. "You know, Maleva did have a great idea. You guys really came through for me. That was the perfect way to cap off the festival and set everything up for the dance." She grinned. "People will be talking about this year's fest for years." Sosuke inclined his head. "Then I must conclude that Operation Winterfest is a success, Miss Chittery." Kaname gave Sosuke a cockeyed grin as she lifted her glass of water and tapped it against his. "I'll drink to that." And so they did.